This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The natural world is full of amazing wildlife. One of our favorite animals to talk about on this show are whales. Whales were the focus of a three-year project by National Geographic photographer Brian Scarry. This week, Where We Live, we feature our best conversations of the year. In May, Scarry joined us to talk about Secrets of the Whales, the name of his new book and docuseries on Disney+. He also worked on a cover story for National Geographic. Scarry traveled to 24 locations around the globe, documenting whales like orcas, humpbacks, belugas, and sperm whales. Coming up, we talk about what he learned and what our role should be to protect these magnificent creatures. Brian Scarry joins us on Zoom. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Lucy. Great to be here.
I mentioned that you're a renowned underwater photojournalist, and you've written several books, including Shark. And if our listeners want to join in on the conversation, they can call 860-275-7266 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Brian, I mentioned that you're a native New Englander. Where did you grow up, and what drew you to underwater photography?
Well, I spent my entire life in Massachusetts in a little textile mill town about 35 miles west of Boston, and actually began scuba diving in New England waters. I got certified when I was about 15 years old and was diving the coast of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. I worked on a charter boat taking folks out to mostly do shipwreck diving for many years out of Rhode Island, and we would sail out of Mystic and Stonington and so places like that. I now live on the coast of Maine. I just moved a couple of years ago to the southern coast of Maine. But New England and New England waters are near and dear to my heart.
I understand your first underwater encounter that really stuck with you related to sharks was back when you saw a female blue shark back in 1982. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, that's right. I was fascinated by sharks. I think I'm probably one of the few people that was actually motivated to go into the ocean after watching Jaws in 1975. But I had never seen one until 1982, and I became friends with a marine biologist, a shark expert named Wes Pratt, who was working at the National Marine Fisheries Lab in Narragansett, Rhode Island for NOAA. And he told me that for the previous few years, he and some of his colleagues would go out each summer off the coast of Rhode Island to look for sharks, and he'd built this homemade little shark cage out of fencing material, and it just, you know, really captured my imagination. So he invited me on one of these trips, and we went out that day in the summer, maybe 20, 30 miles off the coast of Rhode Island, and I remember being in that cage for hours and just sort of looking out at the murky water, bouncing around in my thick wetsuit and, you know, trying not to get seasick and hoping to see a shark, and nothing happened. But then in the afternoon, it was late in the day, maybe 4 p.m. or so, I saw this beautiful, what turned out to be female blue shark, sort of meandering in down the Chum Slick. And they told me later that I was the first person amongst their group that ever left the shark cage. I opened the door and swam out because I wanted to get closer to that animal to try to make a photograph, but also just to be closer to that animal. And I can remember that having this mix of emotions, you know, on one hand, I very much wanted to get close to the animal to see what that was like and to make the picture, but I was also, you know, a little nervous. I didn't know if she would be aggressive or might bite me or anything. And sort of that fear just dissipated as I became hypnotized by how graceful she moved in that deep indigo blue color on her back that blue sharks have. And, you know, to me, it was a profound moment. I remember that it was as if she was on some ancient journey and I was a momentary distraction. And then she swam off into the gloom and I never saw her again. But that brief encounter really sort of hooked me, no pun intended, for the years to come.
How big was this blue shark? You know, I can't believe you opened the cage to swim towards her.
Yeah, you know, she wasn't that large. I mean, blue sharks tend to be in the maybe 2 meters up to 3 meters in length as a rule. Some do get bigger, but so I would say she was maybe 6 or 7 feet in length, which, you know, about the size of a human, let's say. But, you know, underwater in sort of this alien environment where you're not that great with swimming, not compared to a shark, and you're trying to move close to what looks like a very big animal when you're up close to them. So it was a little intimidating, but, you know, I've often said this, that I think, you know, humans and maybe all animals have this sort of this little voice inside that lets us know, or we can pick up on the vibes of animals. And, you know, walk into a neighbor's yard one day and you see their dog and it's wagging its tail and you get a good vibe. Another day, you know, not to bother that dog. And I think it's the same with sharks or maybe other animals, where you just sort of have a vibe that you think it's okay. Maybe that's a little not true all the time, but I think for me anyway, that was the case here. I just didn't feel threatened by that blue shark.
You referenced the movie Jaws. You know, since that movie came out, many people point to that as a disservice to sharks because of the perceptions of them being so dangerous and fearsome.
Yeah, well, it's true, and I think that, you know, it would be hard to argue against that premise that it did a lot of harm and made sharks the villains, and, you know, they were eradicated after that and still are being eradicated today. And it did no great help to sharks. You know, on the other hand, I mean, I do respect the film. The book by Peter Benchley was to me a fun novel to read. As an old-fashioned yarn about the ocean, like Moby Dick or something, I sort of respected. I loved the direction, the acting, and so forth of the movie. And I became friends with Peter Benchley, who wrote the book and the screenplay later in his life. I spent a month diving with Benchley in Cuba. You know, and he became ultimately a great shark conservationist. He spent most of the rest of his life, he died a few years ago, but working on shark conservation issues. He often said that knowing what he knew later in life, he could have never written Jaws. But there's no doubt that it did a lot of harm. And I think, you know, we're still feeling that. It's almost impossible to have a discussion about sharks or any sort of debate about sharks without bringing up the Jaws. You know, it still resonates today, all these years later.
It's one thing to swim alongside them, to have the courage to do so, but then to take pictures of them and to do it well. How do you do it, Brian? And what are the challenges taking pictures underwater?
Well, it's really a great question, Lucy. I think, you know, although wildlife photography in all genres has sort of commonality, there, you know, you have to be very patient, you have to know as much as you can about the behaviors of these animals and so forth. Working underwater is quite different in the sense that, in general, your cameras have to go inside underwater housings, so you can't change film or media cards, you can't change lenses. Whatever you jump in the water with is what you're relegated to using. So if you're taking pictures of little macro creatures and a whale swims by, you know, the best you could do maybe is get a picture of its eye. So you can't, you don't have the flexibility or the freedom. You also have to get very close to your subjects, even in the clearest of water, which is never that clear. But even if you had 100-foot visibility, there's all the properties of light underwater. There's refraction and reflection and scatter. So we can't use a telephoto lens, for example. You know, my terrestrial counterparts can sit in a camouflaged blind somewhere and use a 600-millimeter lens and wait for weeks, perhaps, for an elusive animal to wander past. But we underwater photographers have to get in the water within an hour, maybe as long as the air supply on our back will last. We have to get up close within a meter or two of our subjects and make these pictures. So it really is quite different, and you have to sort of be aware of all of those things and then compose the image and think about light. And oftentimes we're using a little bit of flash to bring back color and detail because the ocean acts like a giant filter. It removes all the warm colors, the reds and the yellows, even just a few feet underwater. So there is a lot more to underwater photography, and it's really ultimately up to the animal. You know, it's a testament to the animals that allow us into their worlds where we can get close and make those images.
On the phone with me again, Brian Scarry, renowned underwater photojournalist and author of several books, including Shark. He's one of the panelists for this weekend's Connecticut Forum on May 11th. More information on our website, WMPR.org. We're previewing a little bit of that conversation today here on Where We Live. Brian, I mentioned you've been photographing for more than three decades. Any advances in the gear you're using that help you stay in the water longer to get close to these magnificent creatures?
Absolutely. You know, I actually started diving in 1977, and I sort of became inspired to be a photographer maybe a year or two later. I remember attending a dive show called the Boston Sea Rover Show, which still goes on today in the spring. And as a teenager, being in that dark audience and seeing photographers and filmmakers present their work, and I often describe it as having an epiphany where I decided that that was how I wanted to explore the ocean with a camera. But back then, you know, cameras were relatively primitive. My first camera was something called a Nikonis camera. It was a Nikonis II, which was one of the early models that Nikon had made of this amphibious camera. And it was, you know, very small. It fit in your hands, a relatively small camera, and you could take it underwater. But it was one roll of film that went inside this little camera, and you had two or three lenses that you had the potential to use for it. Today, you know, things, although it's not magnitudes different, but I'm using the sort of state-of-the-art DSLRs, digital single-lens reflex cameras. I'm still a Nikon shooter, so I'm shooting with the top-end Nikon cameras. I'm putting them in these very well-made, you know, housings that are cast and machined so that you can access all the buttons and dials and so forth. And digital has really been a sea change in terms of how we do things. You know, for many years working for National Geographic, I would go on assignment and shoot 500 rolls of film and not know what I had. And those rolls of film only had 36 frames. So after 36 pictures, you either had to come up or you had to take multiple cameras underwater with you, which is often hard to do. But today, you know, I can shoot thousands of pictures on a single dive, and I can see instantly what I'm shooting. I know what I have before my editor does. I used to wait by the phone for weeks for, you know, a call from my editor in Washington, D.C. at National Geographic to tell me what the film looked like. And, you know, now it's magnitudes different. So I think those things are great. It's also that the camera technology is able to shoot in lower light and working underwater. That's a real advantage to be able to change your film speed, your ISO. You know, if you jump in the water on a bright sunny day and then it gets cloudy and rainy, you can bump up the ISO and still shoot. So there's so many reasons that digital technology and just camera technology in general has improved vastly. And for somebody like me, it's made a tremendous difference.
Brian, you've traveled around the world capturing photographs. We wanted to hone in on sharks and for our listeners to know that you have written a book called Shark with these magnificent photographs. But could you take us into a couple more close encounters, so to speak, including in the Bahamas when you were taking pictures of, I believe, reef sharks and lemon sharks? What happened when an angelfish swam close to you and your group?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I did a story, I think it was in 2007, it was published for National Geographic, about sharks of the Bahamas. And the reason that I had proposed that story was I wanted to use it as a way to talk about the need for shark conservation, that, you know, sharks are being killed at alarming rates around the planet. And, you know, I think part of that equation is that we don't know much about sharks. So the more that we can learn about them and see them for their magnificence, maybe the more we can move the dial in favor of conservation. So I chose the Bahamas as a place to go because it's a sharky place. There's lots of different habitats, and there are mangrove nurseries for baby sharks and reef sharks, and there are deep trenches where different species live. And yeah, I mean, you know, there's always the potential for risk, and sometimes you're in a place and, you know, a fish will swim near you, and whether it's an angelfish or a hogfish or something else, and if the shark is sort of keyed in on that prey item, you know, it can get kind of dicey when you're between what it might be hunting and the animal, the shark itself. So those kinds of things certainly do happen, and it can get a little intense for a few moments. But I have to say that honestly, I've made many hundreds, if not thousands, of dives with sharks throughout my life, and there's a handful of those sort of dicey moments, and far more great moments that outweigh the bad or the scary ones.
Are there any particular species of shark that you won't swim next to, Brian, to get that shot?
Well, even in my book Shark, I document many of the what would be considered more predatory species, the more quote dangerous species. So great whites and makos and oceanic white tips and tigers and bull sharks and all these other species, and pretty much all of those, I'm out there swimming alongside of them, with the exception of the great white. I personally have only photographed great white sharks from inside the protection of a shark cage. Now, there are divers in the world and photographers who I think routinely will swim alongside of them, and you'll see them holding onto their dorsal fins maybe or doing these things. I don't particularly think that's safe. At least in the places where I have photographed great white sharks, there tend to be many of them around, or potentially multiple animals around. And there have been days where I've looked out of the cage in Mexico or South Africa or South Australia, and I see one great white shark sort of swimming around, and I've often believed that, yeah, no problem. I could get out there and get up close and swim with that animal, and it would be fine. But it's not that animal that I'm necessarily so worried about. It's being ambushed by another one from below. And I've seen that kind of thing happen, not with a human or anything, but there have been days where I was watching a shark sort of lazily meander around outside the cage and for hours, and just when you're sort of lulled into that false sense of security, another one comes rocketing up to grab a tuna bait or something that's hanging on a line off the back of the boat. So I think all of this is not without risk, but for me, I would say that knowing what you're doing and taking it cautiously and stacking the deck as much as you can in your favor, having an assistant in the water with me, or maybe sometimes wearing a chainmail suit with certain species and things, I can 99 times out of 100 get in and get close to these animals and not be too worried about my safety. It can be done quite safely. But there are certain species or certain scenarios where, I just won't do that, and that's, a personal choice.
Brian, do you rely on an air supply, or have you gotten pretty good at holding your breath?
Well, I do both, actually. For example, right now I'm two and a half years into a big whale project that I'm doing for National Geographic. So I've been traveling around the world in various locations photographing multiple species of whales. And almost all of that work is free diving. It's breath hold diving. So I'm practicing those techniques and holding my breath and swimming down, into the water and trying to get close to whales and dolphins and so forth. With sharks, it's mostly with scuba. I've used everything from closed circuit rebreathers, although I don't do a lot of that, to free diving with sharks. And I think it just depends on the situation. I've got friends who sort of led me into the notion of snorkeling and free diving with sharks a number of years ago, and particularly with certain species like mako sharks that were a little bit more skittish, that were a little bit more difficult to keep around the boat, and the notion of blowing bubbles with a scuba tank and being sort of this loud thing underwater would be a deterrent to those animals. So we did it with just breath holding, and it seemed to be productive. It worked. So I think it really depends on the situation and the species that you're working with. But I would say that most of the time that I'm doing shark photography, I'm usually using scuba.
You mentioned the makos. I understand that there are two different types, but the mako, many people might be aware that these are popular among sport fishermen. Why is that? Because they're so so fast, and it's a great catch if you're able to catch one, Brian?
Yes, that's exactly right. Mako sharks are certainly one of my favorite species of shark. They're, all sharks, of course, are pretty magnificent to be in the water with. They're all great predators. But there's just something about seeing a mako, particularly underwater, that everything about that animal says predator. They have a superior musculature. They are endothermic. They can generate heat in their body, which makes them very fast. They can swim at speeds of maybe up to 60 miles an hour underwater in short bursts. And for sport fishermen, they are tremendous fighting fish. You know, when you get one on the line, they will jump and leap and fight hard. So I don't do a lot of sport fishing, but for those who do, they marvel at that animal. But, you know, like all species of sharks, they're in steep decline. This is an animal that is hunted for its food, for food and for its fins, and they are in steep decline pretty much throughout their range around the world. So I think that's one of the things we need to bear in mind when we think about, you know, catching any of these species of sharks.
Mm. We mentioned the Bahamas earlier. I was wondering if you could talk about your experience capturing photographs of tiger sharks and what that was like.
Well, yeah, tiger sharks, you know, these are considered to be the most dangerous species of shark in tropical waters, the second most dangerous worldwide after the great white. But it's an animal that has been portrayed as a mindless monster that just eats anything that it comes across in the ocean, and a very, you know, fearful villain has been portrayed as. And I'd spent years, I mean decades really, early in my career, trying to find a place in the world where I could predictably find tiger sharks and get close to them to photograph them. And it ultimately happened when some friends of mine that run a charter boat operation in Florida had sort of discovered this place in the northern Bahamas, which are shallow sand flats, a place that they refer to as Tiger Beach, sort of this generic term to this spread out area, where pretty much on any day now you can go out there and find yourself surrounded by, you know, maybe half a dozen or even a dozen of these big old tiger sharks. And some of them get up to 14 feet in length. And when you get 14 feet long, they get very wide as well and thick. So these are, you know, serious animals. But, you know, I have to say that in the many times that I've been out there photographing tiger sharks, they've been pretty polite. You know, I don't want to be cavalier about this. I think we always have to be very cautious and understand that these are wild animals, that they are potentially dangerous, and particularly if a ecotourism operator is using bait to attract the shark, you know, chum or something, which often has to be done to get close to the animals, you know, that changes the equation a little bit. But it's been done day in and day out for many years now, decades, and it can be done very safely. There's not been a problem with that. So I think to be close to an animal like that is to gain a different perspective and a different sort of respect. And, you know, throughout those decades of misinformation about these animals being just mindless killers and, you know, villains and so forth, divers can become ambassadors now to sort of say, look, you know, yeah, they're serious predators, but we should respect them and not let them be eradicated from our planet. You know, I think I've got photographs, for example, where, you know, you see people nose to nose with a tiger shark, and it's a little shocking to see that kind of a photo, and people look at that and say, oh, wow, did that guy get his head taken off, you know, and the answer is no. And I think the real message of a photo like that is that you wouldn't do that with a lion, right? You wouldn't get out of the Land Rover in the Serengeti and put a stake on the ground and go nose to nose with a lion. We know that would be foolish, but you can do that kind of thing with a tiger shark, and you know, it's not so bad. So I think that's more the message, is that they're not these terrible mindless villains, that they do have degrees of cognition. They scientists are revealing a lot more about what makes them tick, and I think, you know, that as a journalist is what I'm interested in revealing as a way of, you know, celebrating the ocean.
Brian, you mentioned that makos are threatened because of overfishing. With the tiger shark, what challenges do they face, and how does that impact the ecosystem?
Well, that is a really great question. You know, I would put some context to that question by presenting a few facts first, and that is that, you know, we very much live on a water planet. You know, if you look at a picture of Earth from space, it's instantly obvious that we live on a water planet. It's often been said that about three-quarters of the Earth's surface is ocean, but maybe more importantly, 98% of Earth's biosphere, 98% of where life can exist on Earth is ocean. Every other breath that a human being takes comes from the sea. More than 50% of the oxygen you and I are breathing right now, or whether you live in Connecticut or Nebraska or the middle of the Sahara Desert, the oxygen we breathe, most of it is coming from the ocean. So it's in our best interest to protect this ocean planet. And yet the oceans are in real trouble. You know, we've lost 90% of the big fish in the ocean in the last 60 years because we've taken them all. 50% of the world's coral reefs are gone. You've got ocean acidification occurring, which is a product of climate change. We're dumping so much carbon into the atmosphere, and it's being absorbed by the ocean, which is the greatest carbon sink on our planet. It takes in carbon, gives us back oxygen, but it's being maxed out. It's turning acidic, and that's eroding anything with calcium in it that lives in the ocean, which is a serious problem. So sharks are predators, and just like wolves on land or grizzly bears, they play a vital role in keeping ecosystems healthy. And yet every year, right now on planet Earth, we are killing in excess of 100 million sharks, mostly for their fins, for shark fin soup. And we can't remove 100 million apex predators from any ecosystem and expect it to be healthy. And that's one of the problems occurring in Earth's oceans. So whether it's tiger sharks or makos or great whites or any of these other species, they're all suffering from a diminished amount of prey. The food that they would normally go after and eat just isn't there in abundance anymore because we've degraded habitats and we've taken so much fish from the ocean. They're suffering from climate change, you know, this anthropogenic stresses that are occurring in the ocean where it's getting warmer and that's affecting their prey. So we're seeing different migratory patterns of these animals. Some researchers think that tiger sharks, for example, on years when climate is affecting their prey, they're not reproducing, they're not mating. So there may be no age class going forward on those years for that species in certain places. So, you know, these are very complex equations that are occurring underwater in places where we don't often get to see, but we do know enough to know that it's all changing dramatically and quite rapidly because of all of these different things that are happening. So, you know, it's affecting sharks, but it's affecting everything in the ocean.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with renowned underwater photojournalist Brian Scarry. We're going to continue chatting after the break, and we're going to be joined by a marine biologist, too. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Photojournalist Brian Scarry is my guest today. He specializes in marine wildlife and underwater environments. His work for National Geographic over the last two decades has led him around the world capturing amazing photographs. You can have the chance to see some of Brian Scarry's photographs up close and hear the stories behind them at this weekend's Connecticut Forum. We're previewing a bit of that conversation today. I want to take a quick call. Eric from Middletown. Eric, what's your question?
Hi, I have a detailed question about shark safety. A fellow was killed by a great white this past summer at the beach that I have swum at all my life. And what I'm wondering are you safe if you're in the water that's only 5-6 feet deep, where you're sort of body surfing where the waves are breaking, or do great whites in particular sometimes come into the shallower water like that as well?
A great question, Eric. I want to have our next guest help answer that question. Dr. James Solikowski is a marine biologist and professor at the University of New England, joining us via Skype. James, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Were you able to hear Eric's question from Middletown?
I was, yes. That's a great question, too. If I heard it correctly, he was interested in if it's safe to be in waters where you can body surf waist deep.
Yes.
Or so, correct?
Yes.
So I think catching in some of the other comments by Brian, which were amazing, I think that, you know, you have to be diligent wherever you are in the water. And as long as there are seals around, you have to be extra careful. And I think, you know, white sharks will come in shallow and to hunt.
James, earlier we were talking with Brian about, you know, the perception of great white sharks in popular culture. But actually, there's a lot about great whites that we don't know. Can you tell us why?
Well, white sharks are one of those elusive species that you know, migrate great distances. They move around a lot. They're also a protected species. So we have to look at alternative methods in which to study them. And it can be very difficult to catch the individuals that we need to study, the large ones in particular, when you're looking at reproduction and growth rates. So they're highly mobile, and they are can be tricky to catch in that respect. Mm.
Brian Scarry, because you live in New England, you know, you're obviously very familiar with the tensions between people who enjoy going to the Cape, seeing the seals rebound, and now the sharks are also there as well. You've done some photographs with biologist Greg Scommel. What's your take on the return of the great whites here?
Right. Well, first, let me say hello to James. Great to be on the same program with you here, James. But to answer your question, Lucy, yeah, and to address Eric's comment as well, too, about, you know, are you safe in 5 or 6 feet of water in those waters? You know, I think, as James said, I think you have to always be diligent and really be mindful of the fact that this is an unpredictable situation. But, you know, I spent a couple of seasons doing my story about great white sharks on Cape Cod. These are waters that I used to dive in when I was starting out as a diver. I used to dive those exact waters on shipwrecks and photographing lobsters and striped bass and all that kind of wildlife. And today, I quite honestly wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go there. I mean, what we think is happening on the Cape is there seems to be anthropological evidence that shows that there was a robust seal population in that area of Cape Cod, maybe back in the 1600s, maybe around the time that the Pilgrims first came to New England, to Massachusetts. But a lot of those seals were killed by early sealers. They were pretty much wiped out. But in 1972, the United States created the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which was a great thing. It helped protect marine mammals, dolphins, whales, and seals from being killed. And in these decades since 72, those seals, particularly gray seals, have rebounded on the Cape. So we believe that there was probably great white sharks back in the 1600s there in big numbers, but they went away when the seals were all killed, and now they're rediscovering it. So it's really a conservation victory, and at some point it will probably create a natural equilibrium where the sharks will, you know, remove a lot of the seals and you'll get this natural balance. But it is a natural situation that will probably always have some seals and some sharks around. Right now, the common literature about great white shark predation, it states that great whites need about 80 feet of water to ambush a pinniped, a seal. But what we were seeing on Cape Cod is that they're hunting in a very different manner. They're hunting in less than 10 feet of water quite often because that's where the seals are hanging out. So, you know, I think we have to be very mindful of that. And there are organizations out there that, you know, can offer some tips on safety and things to make yourself safer, but at the end of the day, this is a dynamic situation that's evolving quite rapidly, really, and I think, you know, anything that we used to do a decade ago in those waters may not be applicable today.
James Sulikowski, again, marine biologist and professor at the University of New England, is also with us. James, when we hear Brian talk about this conservation success story on the East Coast, we're also curious, because we've touched on it earlier, about the threats that many shark species are facing, including with overfishing and ocean acidification. Can you talk about those threats and what we now know?
Yeah, those are threats that, as Brian kind of alluded to, is have been affecting sharks for quite some time. And that's why we see these population declines. We here in the United States and also in some of the European nations have done a great job of managing those species. And if you look along our coast in the United States, a lot of our sharks are actually recovering, and our populations are getting rebuilding, getting larger, which is great. You know, as Brian said, these are apex predators. We need them to keep our ecosystems clean and in balance. It's other areas of the world where the management isn't tight or there is no management at all. And that's where we get into the situation where these unregulated fisheries that really have been decimating our sharks. And here in the United States, we're doing a great job at it. And so that's, we can kind of focus on that and kind of bridge our ability to help these other nations do a better job at their management purposes. That's step number one. With climate change and ocean acidification, we're just understanding what those causes might be. And as Brian said, you're looking at all sorts of different changes and how fast individuals are able to reproduce, where they reproduce. Are their nursery ground habitats shifting? Do they need to find new areas, new food sources? And everything goes along with that. You know, most people don't know this, but a lot of shark species lay eggs, and those eggs sit on the ground. And if you're not in an environment that's conducive for that, then it can cause problems with the development of those embryos within those eggs. So it's a multifaceted problem that sharks are facing. And the only way that we can really help that is if we, you know, work together as a community, as a species, in order to better manage and conserve those individuals.
What about the issue of plastics in our oceans? Brian, I believe you were just in Portugal talking about this very issue.
Yeah, I was. I just got home on Saturday from speaking engagements in Porto, Portugal, and in Oxfordshire, England. And a big part of the discussion with these folks was about plastics in the ocean. It's become such a huge problem. National Geographic has launched this multi-year initiative called Planet or Plastic. You know, basically make a choice. Are we going to have plastic or are we going to have a planet? Because, you know, the latest statistics sort of indicate that every single year right now on our planet, we are putting about 18 billion pounds of plastic into the ocean. That's a staggering number. And I've seen it everywhere I go. You know, I've been on some of the most remote islands in the world, places that took me 6 days by boat from Fiji to get to, these uninhabited islands in the middle of the central South Pacific, and walked along what should have been pristine white beaches, sandy beaches, and was up to my calves in plastic trash for a mile. It's everywhere. You see it in the ocean. I just came back a couple of weeks ago from Sri Lanka. I was on assignment for almost a month in Sri Lanka, and on multiple occasions out there, I jumped in the water and cut out sea turtles that were wrapped in plastic fishing net, or one was even towing a laundry basket. It was wrapped in an orange plastic basket that it became entangled in. So we're seeing it everywhere. It's in the deepest parts of the ocean, and it's on our beaches. It's inside most animals in the ocean, and therefore it's inside of us, and obviously having a harmful effect. So, you know, I think what I've learned by talking to folks who really study this issue is that, you know, we obviously have to reduce the amount that we're putting out there. And a lot of this has to do with embracing a circular economy where manufacturers have to sort of take ownership of the products that they're making, you know, that they can no longer just make something and let it be bought by a consumer and then be done with it. That if there are plastic parts in whatever they make, that they have to sort of own it from cradle to cradle. They have to be able to take it back and reuse that, so we're not putting as much out there. We obviously have to eliminate single-use plastics, which can be done. So this is, you know, a big task. There's not a silver bullet, but there's many things that I think we can be doing as you know, human beings to reduce the amount of plastic we're putting out there in nature and certainly in the ocean. Mm.
Brian Skerr, again, is a renowned underwater photojournalist who's been with us to talk a little bit about his career. He's going to be at the Connecticut Forum this Saturday, May 11th. More information at ctforum.org. Brian, before I let you go, any advice to aspiring underwater photographers out there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I would say that we live at a very interesting time in terms of exploration, and particularly in the ocean. You know, we have really fascinating science being done by James, as you know, he'll talk a little bit more about, whether it's sharks or whales or whatever it is. But we need good storytellers. So I would say, if you're interested in becoming an underwater photographer, doing this kind of work, you know, follow that passion, create a strategy for, you know, how to get to where you want to be, create a great, strong portfolio, and then get out there and do the things that really interest you. But it's a good time. Technology is exciting, and the ocean still remains largely unexplored. So there's lots of grist for the mill out there for anybody who wants to do it.
Well, Brian, thanks again for your time, and look forward to talking with you on Saturday.
Same here. Thank you.
Bye-bye. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Dr. James Sulikowski is going to stay with us. He's a marine biologist and professor at the University of New England. We're going to ask him more about different shark species, rather, that we see in our neck of the woods. And if you have a question, you can join us, too. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we've been learning more about underwater photography with Brian Scarry, but also about the very many different shark species out there. With us via Skype is Dr. James Sulikowski, marine biologist and professor at the University of New England. James, we were learning a little bit about, you know, why species like the great white are so elusive, and it's hard to capture data, specifically the reproduction data. I understand you're working on a project that might help scientists and others get more data about specific shark species. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think when you look at what Brian discussed and kind of what we'll talk about now, is sharks are elusive and they are hard to catch. And not only are they hard to catch, but they're hard to catch at certain life history stages that we want to study. And one of those life history stages is pregnant females. We right now are working to develop this new tag. It's actually called the Birth Alert Tag, which is an intrauterine satellite tag. And most people think about satellite tags as tracking movement patterns. And they can be tags that are placed on a dorsal fin. When the shark comes up, it transmits a location. But these tags are a little bit different. Same technology. But when this tag is inserted into a female, she carries it along with her pups. And when those pups are born, that tag pops out so we can get a location of where that actually occurred. And that's really important because where these areas are located, we refer to them as nursery grounds. So just like we might drop our children off at a daycare or nursery, where they're protected and you know, cared for, these nursery grounds sort of provide that same habitat for baby sharks. And knowing where they are and the timing of these birth events helps us to protect these areas a little bit better. Mm. And so we get to link some really cool methodologies together. So we perform an ultrasound on sharks. We also place a fin mount tag on the mother so we can track her movements as well. And so we hope that this will provide this sort of holy grail of shark research for these mobile species, such as white sharks and tiger sharks and poor beagle sharks and whatnot.
And where exactly are you tagging these specific sharks?
So this is a great question. We're in collaborating right now with the University of Miami and my colleague, Dr. Neil Hammerschlag. And we are working on an area that Brian described, Tiger Beach in the Bahamas. I mean, it's a known area that Neil has been studying for quite some time. And we've been researching tiger shark reproduction there. And they provide a really great model to really see how this tag will work, what modifications we need to make for the tag in order to use it across a wide range of different shark species.
Are there any concerns how these devices that you will be putting into female sharks, how they might impact pups?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this tag has been in development for over 2 years with all those concerns in mind. So the size and the shape of the tag, you can imagine that the tag sort of looks like an egg. So it's small when you talk about a 14-foot shark. It's not a lot of space. It's a device that doesn't cause any harm to the pups while it's inside. It's not going to corrode or anything like that. So any kind of precautions that were necessary were taken along the way. And it's also something that we've worked through all the necessary protocols at different universities as well, as far as the animal care and use of and keeping all those sorts of things in mind. Mm.
I mentioned that you're a professor at the University of New England. Again, great whites get a lot of attention up here, but if you could tell us a little bit more about maybe some other types of sharks that we would possibly are in our waters and why they're here, James?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most people, if you were to talk to them, only think that we have white sharks, but we actually have eight different species here in New England that are close to shore that you might interact with. And some of the iconic ones are the Mako sharks. I think everybody can recognize that. We also have blue sharks, sand tiger sharks, poor beagle sharks, spiny dogfish. We have basking sharks and, of course, white sharks. And we have thresher sharks. So we have quite the array of individuals that are close to shore. And we're talking, you know, somewhere within, you know, 5 to 10 miles. And once you get farther offshore into the Gulf Stream, then it's a whole other can of worms, and you get all the tropical species that kind of move up. So it's a pretty dynamic place. Mm.
We were hoping to speak with a researcher about lost sharks, but if you could tell us what you know as a marine biologist of those particular sharks.
Yeah, the one thing that I think Brian alluded to is, you know, our understanding in general of sharks is very limited. And there are, if you were to look across the spectrum, what we do know is constantly changing because of climate change and habitat destruction and overfishing. So we're constantly relearning what we know about sharks. So when you talk about lost sharks, things that may live in the deep that we are just now being discovered, it becomes even more challenging. And to be honest with you, we've got sharks that are 5 to 10 miles offshore here in New England that we know very little about. One's the poor beagle, which we've sort of nicknamed the phantom shark because it's so hard and cryptic to find and to get a good understanding about its biology. Mm.
James, we can't let the hour go without mentioning that UN report on biodiversity that just came out and 1 million species of plants and animals in danger of extinction. As a marine biologist, last words for our listeners about some things that they should be thinking about that could help reverse this terrible trend.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think what we have to understand as people and as human beings that live on the planet is that our everyday use of plastics and other things really have a long-lasting impact. And we need to really think about staying green as well as looking at ways in which we can look to integrate with the ecosystem and work better to allow entities to enjoy the water, like tourists and commercial fishing and recreational fishing to go on, but yet let those individuals, those animals, strike a balance between what we want to do and how they need to live. Mm.
Dr. James Sulikowski, again, is a marine biologist, professor at the University of New England, joining us today via Skype. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show produced by Lydia Brown. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. You can learn more about the show at wnpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.